The meeting is now live and active.
Okay, well, it looks like we got most everybody here. So we'll start opening the meeting, the ATU 757 Pension Trust. We'll do first a roll call of the trustees. And, you know, as I call your name, just say you're here for the record. So we'll start off with Bill Bradley here. Stephen Yet.
For the record, here.
Christina Hsu.
Here.
Aurora Jackson.
Present.
John Hampton.
There.
John Hunt is not here. He will not be here today. Okay, so with that, we'll start with our agenda. We had the minutes sent out to our email. I know Sarah said that there might be some adjustments from RBK, but I didn't see anything come through. So without that, if everybody read them and is okay with them, I'll just take a motion to approve the minutes from the May 13th, 2020 meeting.
I'll second that.
It's been seconded. Any discussion? Seeing none, seeing no hands, we'll take a vote. So all in favor, aye.
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 A motion passed unanimously. Okay, so with that, we'll hand it over to the investment consultant and we'll get a report on a quarterly performance update. So we'll start with you, Ian.
All right, thank you, Bill. I'm going to share my screen. Hold on just a second. Can everybody see that and hear me fine? All yep. Right, seeing some nodding heads, I will pick off. So great to see everybody. Wish we were all in person, but looks like we're gonna be like this probably for a little while. Happy to go over some capital markets first, and then I'll run over to the plan performance. That's all I've got on the agenda today, so hopefully won't take too long. As you're looking here, this is kind of a snapshot of the capital markets as of June 30th. So I'll provide some high level comments here, and then jump into maybe a bit more recent economic activity. But essentially, we've seen, and I know we mentioned this kind of at the last meeting, as you know, obviously we met in May, so we had obviously seen a good chunk of what markets had done through the second quarter. But essentially, it has been an astonishing rebound, if you will, with risk assets from the bottoming out after the beginnings of the COVID-19 crisis. So, you know, that's not to say that the economic recovery that we're seeing in the US and across the globe is necessarily following what markets are in or have done post March, really. But so there certainly is some kind of a bifurcation, if you will, between what we're getting from economic data and what markets are pricing in. So maybe I'll start kind of just on the market side of things, and then we'll maybe talk about some of the disconnect that we're seeing on the economic side of things. So with markets, if you look in that bottom left-hand corner, I'm not sure if my cursor necessarily shows up here on the screen, but in that bottom left-hand QTD column there, you can see some pretty astonishing figures, almost an exact reversal to some extent of what we saw in Q1. S&P was up almost 20-some percent, 20.5%, if you will. That's really the best quarter we've seen since almost 1970s. It's a pretty remarkable figure that has really almost dug ourselves out of the whole year to date as of this point. Now, if you were going to fast forward this snapshot through yesterday, the S&P is actually up handedly almost 5% this year, which is pretty crazy to think about that we had such a strong and quick sell-off in Q1. We've seen almost just as strong and or a quick, just as quick of a rebound, if you will, through the year to date so far. I actually wanted to pull up real quick, and this isn't in your materials, but this chart right here, if you would look, This is one I found just the other day, and this kind of brings it full circle a little bit through kind of more through yesterday, if you will. But you can see there, the market peaked at about February, and then we had this dramatic sell-off, very, very quick dramatic sell-off down about 30-some percent. And you can see that line and how that's really materialized forward back to the point where now we're actually above the previous peak, and we're actually, the S&P the other day was back to setting a new record in terms of index value. You can see that the recovery hasn't been quite as quick as the sell-off was, but it's been pretty prolonged, even as a lot of those events indicate on that chart there. We've had a lot of negative news, lots of deaths, lots of unemployment reaching levels that we haven't seen in decades, but the market has still trumped through going forward. So that's a pretty good indication of kind of the bifurcation that we're seeing between economic data and markets. On the fixed income side of things, if you look at the bottom right hand box on this page, the Treasury yield curve, you can see that the two lines, the blue and the green, pretty much laying right on top of each other. Not a lot of movement in yields from the Fed after the response that we saw from them in March. You know, they've been plenty busy doing backstopping and providing liquidity to markets in a host of areas, a lot of places that they had never ventured before. One more recent events is them actually providing liquidity to corporations in the form of actually purchasing corporate debt, as opposed to simply just going out in the market and buying their own treasuries, which is something they had never done before. So we're still in some pretty, I hate to use the word unprecedented times, because we hear this all the time, but you know, without a better vocabulary here, I'm going to use it. I'm going to rely on that. And it really is unprecedented in terms of things that we're seeing the Fed and the government do to backstop the economic damage that we saw in the first quarter. So I did want to just kind of lay that out, because we're going to see some pretty great numbers here in terms of plan performance in Q2. And if you were going to fast forward through today, plan performance would be even better with most risk assets up quite handedly so far. So maybe I'll stop there. I'm happy to jump into a whole host of economic activity that has happened over the past few months. I found in a few of my other client meetings that people seem to be a little bit more tuned into the economic data and or markets than are normally present. So I don't want to bore you with facts or data that you've already heard. So maybe I'll just open it up to the committee. Are there any specific questions that you're mulling over or thinking about maybe before we jump into actual plan performance?
You know, I'll ask a question. So I was listening to the radio the other day, and they say people are just going to these blue chip, you know, stocks because there's no money to be made in bonds. It's just there's nowhere to put your money without losing money. That's safe. And so you see in a rush to the blue chips, like, you know, Facebooks and the Amazons and that stuff, just as a way to put their money somewhere that's relatively safe and inoculated from the pandemic. Do we see anything within our portfolio from the fixed income side, from the bond side, that says we should continue down the line? Because I know these interest rates were probably low for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. And you know, I'd say that there's probably a number of ways to answer that. One is, you're right. There's been a lot of money chasing a very limited number of stocks. And if you don't mind me jumping around a little bit, let me see here. I actually had a few other pages that I was looking at this morning. This page right here just shows you the concentration of the S&P 500, its makeup today, and the weightings of those top five stocks, if you will. So as you can see here, you know, the top, this line on the bottom left, forward earnings, the top five firms there have a lot higher earning potential than the S&P X, the top 500. or excuse me, X those top five. And I think even a more a scary chart to some extent is this line right here and the weight of the top five in the S&P 500. So the weight of those top five has been trending up. If you think about, you know, obviously the S&P 500, 500 of the biggest companies in the U.S., really some of the 500 biggest companies in the world, those top five now make up over 20% of the S&P 500, which to me, as an institutional investor, actually scares me to a great extent, because the index is now so concentrated in a few names. And I'm not necessarily saying this is the time that it will happen, but in history has shown us that when things get that concentrated at the top, bad things tend to happen. So tech bubble, that happened because of, you know, the dot-com bubble happened at the same exact time. If you look back to some of these metrics down here, we had a lot of that same concentration at the top before bubbles popped. Now, the flip side of that coin is these companies that are at the top of the S&P 500 are actually finally now profitable. These are not non-profitable companies. A lot of these companies are actually making really good revenue in terms of advertising sales and just normal sales for something like, you know, Microsoft and Google and Amazon. But the flip side of that, and this is the fixed income story that you mentioned, is what is the role of fixed income in the portfolio? So you're right, the retail investor, you know, the individual investor has certainly been chasing kind of those top names and or equity names because there's no yield to be made really in fixed income right now. Now, again, let's delineate. There's a whole host of fixed income instruments, not just one, right? So U.S. Treasuries is what most people think of when they think of fixed income, because it's, you know, it's the safest, and that's what's represented here in this Treasury yield curve, is what are Treasuries trading at in terms of yield. They're definitely not an attractive place to be with respect to forward earnings outlook, or how much they could potentially earn in the next 10 years, if you will. But what they do offer is some valuable diversification benefits, right? So when things do sell off, what provides you some kind of positive return or at least flat return? Well, fixed income generally offers you that. And then with respect to your portfolio, we've got a few managers in here, and we'll go through that too, right? We've got two main fixed income components in the portfolio. And one is a passive allocation that has a lot of that treasury safe asset exposure to it. Forward-looking return potential on that, not great, right? Not a terribly great forward-looking return potential, but the diversification benefits of that allocation are the strongest probably of anything in the portfolio. The other manager, Double Line, is the one that's actually doing really well in terms of trying to pick up additional yield from a little bit more risky fixed income. So things like emerging market debt, things like high yield. And those are things that have actually done really well in addition to equities, you know, in this second quarter. So high yield's up 10%+ from the bottom of March, whereas treasuries are really only up about 1% or 2%, depending on where you are in the yield curve. So a long-winded response there. I didn't mean to trail off, but it's a really relevant question, and it's one that a lot of our clients are asking themselves, which is hence why we put some of these additional charts together, because it does remind you that chasing the top performers is usually a game that will eventually bite you, and in a way that you don't necessarily want it to. So how do we build an institutional portfolio like we've done here? Well, we've got to take some kind of risk mitigation techniques, and that main risk mitigation technique that we have is really relying on that fixed income allocation, even though the forward return perspectives don't look that great. But when things sell off, and they very well could again, if we hit some kind of a second wave, the market's pricing in right now a lot of activity that hasn't happened yet, right? Markets pricing in vaccines coming sooner than later. Markets pricing everybody getting back to normal business sooner than later. We start seeing things that start pushing economic activity down further and or not allowing us to open up quicker. A whole host of issues. We still got the election that we haven't even talked about in November. There's so many like macro events that could happen. You know, that's when you're going to be glad that you had that fixed income allocation. So it's one that we like to remind people that it's not the, you know, it's not the sexiest allocation in your portfolio, but it is there for a reason for sure.
I appreciate the knowledge there, Ian. I always like to get a little bit more out of you if we can.
Yeah, well, happy to give it here. I could talk to you about that for hours if you'd like. Any additional questions on capital markets from anybody? Okay, hearing none, I'm gonna skip ahead a few pages to the portfolio here as of June 30th. So let me see if I can get this a little more centered. There we go. So actually a pretty good second quarter. We'll look at the quarter to date turn, or excuse me, in just a second. But as you can see here on the bottom, you know, calendar year to date started out at about 33 million about, had a pretty ugly first quarter. If you remember, you know, most plans did, almost every plan did, but pretty amazing to see that year to date only down about 3.5% through June 30th and almost back up to that 33 million point. I did reach out to my team this morning to try to get a little more updated figure. I'm going to check to see if they've got that here in a second, but we're almost back up. If I would assume, you know, if we're down 3% through the end of June, if I had to take kind of an educated guess of where the portfolio probably is through maybe like yesterday's close, we've got to be close to back to even, if not maybe a little bit above in positive territory. So again, pretty amazing when we think about the portfolio is down 20-some% in Q1, that we're already back to where we started the year out at. And a lot of that is to do with some of the things we just discussed. You've got some really good tilts in terms of equity allocations, but the fixed income allocation has been doing a solid job as well. The second part of that really, really helped was that if you recall, right when markets were kind of bottoming out, if you recall, remember we breached our stated bands for the asset allocation ranges. We held that special kind of rebalance meeting to make sure that we brought the allocation back to target. That could not have been, I mean, I don't want to claim any kind of a timing perspective because nobody can predict what's going to happen in the future, but that's exactly why we have bands in the policy that force us to take those rebalancing actions when we breach the bands. And it could not have been done at a more better time. We basically did it right when markets had bottomed out. We sold out of fixed income, bought into equities, realigned the target allocations. And so this whole run-up of equities that we've seen in the past couple months, that was at starting at target weight instead of equities starting in a hole. So that really also helped the portfolio a ton over the past few months. You can see now we're actually almost slightly overweight in US equity to a fair degree because of that rebalancing activity and bringing it back to neutral before this amazing run-up. So it's actually almost to the point now where my team's keeping a pretty good eye on it in terms of where it sits within the ranges, just to make sure that if we need to trim a little bit of the gains on the opposite side of things back into fixed income, in case we start to see markets deteriorate a little bit, that we can take the opposite side of that coin, be a little bit more neutral. So that's something where, if you recall, Jeff and I worked together to revise the policy so that going forward, if those bans are breached, we don't have to have a special meeting anymore. The chair can authorize rebalancing back to target as long as the bans are breached. So I'll be keeping a close eye on these allocations and how they sit versus the bans to make sure that if they are breached on the upper side, that we trim gains a little bit and use that as an opportunity to rebalance in the fixed income to make sure that we've got enough risk mitigation tools in the portfolio going forward.
Ian, just a question.
Yep.
On the bands, with UpToDate, where do you think we are with the overweight in domestic equity versus the underweight in fixed income?
Yeah, I would probably say, you know, we're probably approaching, I'm guessing probably 3% overweight on domestic equity, you know, to some extent. So, you know, we technically have a plus 5 band, I think, on domestic equity. If you can see here on the top, domestic equity's target allocation is 31. We've got a plus or minus 5 band on that. We're probably, you know, I want to say we're probably 3 or 3.5 on that. We don't technically have to wait. The committee can authorize a rebalance at any time. You don't technically have to wait until you breach that upper band. But this is, you know, this is the art, not the science of investing. It's where, you know, where do you feel comfortable in terms of letting your winners run, if you will. So, you know, to me, I think if this starts to get, if speed continues to increase in terms of equity performance in the coming, you know, month or so, I would think that but we're sitting here in mid-September and we haven't really seen much of a pullback in equities and we're getting closer to that 4% range, even though it's within the top band of the policy, which is 36 would be the max. We're at 33.5 right now. I would think that that's probably about the time to at least initiate the conversation so that we don't get into a situation like we were last time where the band was actually breached. If you can rebalance it slightly before the band is actually breached, I tend to think that that's a little bit better of a risk mitigating tool than simply setting it and forgetting it and literally doing nothing until the band is breached. So we kind of want to keep an eye on what the temperature of the market is and when we might forecast that we could hit that top band. To me, that seems like, you know, right now, if we're probably at 3.5 over, I think probably once if it runs another few weeks, the market does, that's probably a time when I'll lob an email into the committee to say, hey, look, we're sitting at about a little over 4% overweight, and I'll try to see if what we are actually as of today. I'll get an update before the end of the meeting, as of yesterday's close, and maybe I'll relay that after my section is over a little later in the meeting. But if we're getting 4+, I think that's about the time when I would feel most comfortable initiating the conversation of either bringing it all the way back to target or at least bringing it halfway back to target. That usually is your main two options.
Thanks, Ian. Is there any history when it comes to presidential elections of, you know, just the market becoming conservative anyway and trying to, you know, realize the gains just because of the uncertainty? Is that a traditional 4-year practice?
There's been some mixed data in terms of historically, you know, what markets do in and around elections. The more reliable data really is usually markets tend to favor one party over the other. And there's usually two things happen leading up to an election. One, volatility almost always increases. So you see bigger up days and bigger down days. So it's kind of hard to predict whether or not those are going to be consistently up or consistently down, but almost always, you know, if you're looking at like the VIX, which is a volatility indicator, you tend to see some pretty good spikes leading into any kind of election. That's not just the US election, that's elections all over the world. And the second part of that is usually one party's favored over the other in terms of what the markets are pricing in. So if you know, markets are more favorable to the Republican Party, for example, if it looks like that's going to be the outcome, then usually you start seeing a little positive of a swing. If maybe they're disfavoring Democrats, then usually you start to see markets trail off a little bit. But it, I would say that, you know, it's really tough to predict. And so just being a little bit more neutral to target weights around macro events that could have a big swing one way or the other is usually my more consistent approach. I don't want to be really wide off the target right before a big macro event like that. So I think that's why if markets continue to run a little bit, knowing we've got volatility coming likely in October and November, that's probably a point in September. That's kind of why I picked that, that it's probably a bit responsible of us to just kind of bring it back to target. That way, if we do have a big upswing, you know, hey, maybe we missed out on a little bit of gains, but if we get a really big sell-off, we're not overweight risk assets.
All right. Well, thank you, Ian.
I'm going to just switch here a little bit farther forward on page 16. So here you can see performance for the total fund versus the benchmark and versus peer plans for the quarter. Again, some really, you know, if you recall, a lot of our, you know, the peers we're looking at here, we say this a lot in really volatile quarters, but a lot of them have things like big allocations to private equity, big allocations to private real estate, big allocations to hedge funds, essentially asset classes that don't price as frequently as the assets that we hold here in a more liquid portfolio. So that tends to give you kind of these lumpy rankings when things happen like this. You know, in Q1, if you recall, had a pretty bad peer ranking because, you know, probably I would say out of all the pension plans that have under $100 million in assets, I'd say probably, you know, half of them have some kind of a private portfolio that hadn't priced yet or hadn't been marked to market. So they weren't experiencing the full downturn of that. On the flip side of things, on a quarter like we just had, where our portfolio is 100% liquid, we're fully realizing the upswing in pricing that we saw in Q2, which is why the ranking is 8 in the top decile. So I always like to say, you know, hey, that calendar year to date, is it really 82? No, it's probably a lot closer to peer median. Quarter to date, is that a top decile? No, it's probably a little closer to 25th percentile or something to that nature, simply because the assets of our peers in a lot of plans just haven't been priced very well. But to that extent, it still was, when we look at our own benchmark, you know, how we're doing versus the target allocation index. So that's the, if we could implement our entire portfolio passively, what would we have gotten? Well, that would have been up 13% for the second quarter, and the portfolio did best that by almost 230 basis points, which is a huge quarter in terms of outperformance. So really strong quarter here. Don't want to take anything away from that. And I think more importantly, we got that from a lot of different places. We got outperformance in the domestic equity portfolio. We got it in the international equity portfolio. We got it in the fixed income portfolio, in the real return portfolio, and the GTA portfolio. So I was really, really happy with the combination of these managers and how they did in Q2. Because they all outperformed their respective benchmarks at the composite level, which I will say, you know, I've been doing this a long time. You don't see that very often. So you take it with a pat on the back when you can, because that's a pretty strong quarter in terms of outperformance. I'm going to go a little bit farther into the manager section and just and kind of show you a few highlights here. Again, I think it's really important to kind of look at these, both the outperformance, so the difference column of these managers versus their benchmarks, but also how they ranked versus other like-to-like kind of funds. And you can see here really just some outstanding performance across the board. Almost every single manager outperformed their respective benchmark and ranked above median for the quarter. You know, in a really crazy world, it's nuts to see somewhere where like LSV, who outperformed the index by 110 basis points, yet still ranked 83rd as a peer. You know, that just doesn't happen very often, where you beat the benchmark and you underperform your peers by that extent. But that just goes to show you how strong the rally was in Q2. So we had some really strong outperformance from all the equity managers. And then here, and this is kind of back to your point, Bill, you know, when we started talking about what does the fixed income portfolio look like for your portfolio? Well, you know, that's why we've got kind of these two, this dual approach to fixed income. We've got the Vanguard Total Bond, which is our passive piece, lots of high quality treasuries, US agencies, very high rated corporate debt, just the risk level super low there. The return potential going forward is actually is pretty low too though. So that's why we've got this kind of second arm of the fixed income portfolio, which is the double line piece. You can see there they had a really strong quarter, but calendar year to date trailing quite a bit because they had a lot more of those risk assets. They had, you know, lower quality companies, emerging market debt, some places within the fixed income market that going forward look much more attractive than treasuries. But so far this year, obviously treasuries have been king. Treasuries really have outperformed almost everything up until about a few weeks ago. So that just kind of puts in perspective how we've built the fixed income portfolio to navigate different environments and to supplement what we've got going on the equity side of things. And then kind of to finish out my comments for the day, you know, both PineBridge and PIMCO had some pretty great second quarter performance as well versus their respective benchmarks, especially PIMCO, the inflation response portfolio. You know, that's something where if you've probably seen in the news, like gold is starting to take off and some real assets are really starting to take off, and they tend to do well in environments like we've seen recently. So, that's why we've got some of those additional levers in the portfolio as well to take advantage of some of the esoteric natures of markets when we get to be in some kind of a stagflation type environment that we kind of tend to see ourselves in lately. So, I'll stop there. I don't want to talk too much and monopolize too much of the time, but happy to answer any other questions, but I'll just leave it on a positive note. Really great performance from the portfolio in Q2. I would assume we're probably back into positive territory overall, and I'll be for sure watching where we sit in terms of our allocations versus the target and make sure to send the trustees an email once we start getting to, hopefully, that upper end of the domestic equity range, because if we do start reaching, 4%+ overweight, this portfolio really is going to benefit from that since we do have an overweight to U.S. versus international.
Any other questions for Ian from any of the trustees for this? Okay, looks like you got an IPS update.
Yeah, is that my piece, Jeff, or is that yours? I think the only IPS update was that we made the updates per the motion that was made at the previous meeting to strike the one little line of language. So I've documented the approved IPS as of the May meeting to reflect the conversation that we had at the May meeting, per my earlier note about if we do reach those bands and or if a rebalance is needed, that can be initiated by the chair on behalf of all the trustees. So that is officially now documented as of the May meeting.
All right, I would just ask Jeff, I suppose, to send out a fresh copy of that to the trustees when he can.
And I've actually got a copy of that as well. So maybe while we're on the meeting here today, I'll make sure to send fresh copies of the clean IPS to all the trustees.
Thank you, Ian. Okay. Anybody have any other comments on Ian's reports?
I don't. None? Thank you, Ian, for the update. Thank you.
Thank you all.
Yeah, thank you, Ian. We'll move on to the report of the actuary, estimated fund status.
Yep. Our agenda items really brief today. As everyone on the committee knows, we finalized the January 1 valuation report after the last meeting, and everyone should have a copy of that. If there's any questions, certainly happy to address those. But the only real update we wanted to give you today was sort of piggybacking off of the news Ian had with the asset return side of things. If we look at where things were through the end of June and kind of translate that over into funded status, compared to the beginning of year funded status of about 69% of the plan, it would, based on assets at the end of June, would translate to about a 66% funded status. So the, you know, the big down in the first quarter, the recovery in the second quarter, brought us back to just a few percentage points lower than the beginning funded status. If we were to bring in what's happened since June 30, narrow that gap a little bit more. But I just remind you that even if we're back to say flat on the year on the asset side, long-term there's a bogey of what now is 5.75% expected rate of return built into the valuation. So that's really what we're judging by to improve funded status over time. But bear in mind, that is 6 months through a 2-year cycle before the next valuation. So that's kind of where we're at the moment. With that, if there's any questions, be happy to answer them on either that or other actuarial or valuation questions.
Anybody have any questions for Scott? Hearing none, seeing no hands up. Thank you, Scott, for that quick update. Hopefully we can get somewhere near that 5.75. That would be great. Fingers crossed. I don't want to be too optimistic though. Okay, so report of the attorney. Jeff, I know you don't have anything on the agenda item. Listening in, thinking while you've been sitting there, if you have anything to add before we move on to the administrators, you have the floor.
Nothing to add.
Okay. Well, not too much delay then, and then we'll go straight to the administrator's report. Who's going to take that? Sarah?
I'll go ahead and do that. I sent out the cash flow and the expenses and retirees since the last meeting. If you notice, that list has grown quite a bit. Let's see. There was really nothing out of the ordinary with regards to the expenses. Everything seems to be pretty consistent. I'll open it up for any questions on the expenses and retirees. Going.
I would just say, how's the processing of these retirees going? Is there anything we can do to make it easier on you? In terms of our process?
No, not really. I mean, Lydia and I are in contact pretty much about making sure that certain forms are filled out completely, those kinds of things. She's very helpful with getting in contact with any retirees if there's additional information that needs to be done. Most of it's going pretty well. We did do a couple EPA beneficiaries. We found out that an ex-employee had passed away back in 2006. So we distributed that to her two sons this last time, and that was noted. So that was just a lump sum payment. But other than that, no, it just, when we get just with the processing of payroll, when we get the applications, once I process everything, I kind of have to wait for final hours and everything from Jeff Haas. And so it just does take a little bit of time. I like to tell people it'll take 30 to 60 days. It's really kind of dependent on when I get the application, when payday falls, when the bank needs the ACH. So it's really kind of a lot of moving parts that we kind of have to take into consideration that a lot of people don't really quite understand. They just think, oh, I get it in, I should get my payment right now, but it really doesn't work that way. So everybody's been really, really good. These have gone pretty smoothly. We had a couple buybacks of time, which went really well. So nothing really.
Just thought I'd check in. I just know that's a longer list than I'm used to, so. Thanks for all the work, and it's been definitely an interesting time around here, and we're sad to see a lot of these faces go.
Yeah.
Really good coworkers.
Yeah. So as far as the cash flow, or let's see, we've got the bill.com. So I do have, I got to try and find the, I do have, and I did send out the bill.com security overview. I want to make sure that the trustees did get that. You know, it looks like they are SOC 1 and SOC 2 secure, which means that they, SOC 1 and SOC 2 type 2 audits every year by a national CPA firm. So they are, you know, financially covered.
So those audits are audits. A SOC audit is generally an audit of internal controls. So you can get the SOC audit report and it will tell you, bill.com will describe in that report their controls they have in place, and the auditor will verify that those controls are in place and working. So when you read the SOC report, you get a good feel for the company's focus on internal controls and how well they're doing at making sure their policies are being followed.
I watched your overview and, you know, obviously I was one of the ones early on saying, well, how does this work? Is it secure? You know, is it, if I use my phone, is there something that I could let out? And it seemed very straightforward and simple. You know, we've kind of adapted to some Adobe Sign stuff here when it comes to retirement pension applications and doing things digitally. And I think this is a logical next step. And, you know, I personally don't have anything to say stop the progress, if that helps smooth things over. I know David had to chase me down yesterday to get some checks signed. And, you know, it's always a joy to bring them out into the workplace sometimes.
Well, I think if you know, the trustees are comfortable with it, I think that we do need to maybe take a vote on starting this process, because, you know, of course, the hand delivery of the checks and the mailing and stuff, you know, we get a bill from Hirschner Hunter that has last month's check on it. And I'm like, wait a minute, didn't we pay that? And I have to go back. Yes, we did. And so, you know, there's just this lagging of this payments that can be eliminated and the tracking down eliminated. All you have to do is push your button and say, yes, pay, please.
If we move to bill.com, we'll have an email address, something like, you know, ltdpension@bill.com, where if Hirschner Hunter sends a invoice or Milliman sends an invoice, bill.com actually learns who that invoice is and codes it for us, and then we'll send it to you guys for approval once Sarah has looked at it, reviewed it, and sent it. And it works pretty slick. We've moved probably for the last 6 months to doing that for our company accounts payable, and it makes things go smoother.
And when Dean's talking about coding, what he means is I keep all the books in QuickBooks. So we have codes of, you know, meeting expenses, that kind of thing. So when the bill comes through, I can just upload that straight into QuickBooks. And that also takes away the data entry, you know.
Mistakes or anything.
Mistakes and those kinds of things.
You know, I would, if you guys need a motion, I would entertain a motion. I would defer maybe to Christina, since she's our financial expert when it comes to the books. If she has any comment on bill.com, and I think it would be great if she made the motion.
Well, I think that is a good change, because it would, I think it would help track down, make it easier for our bill paying and our signing of the checks. And I also think, since it's past the SOX, it would be secure. So I would vote for it. Yeah. Thank you.
Okay, well, we'll just make it clear and say a motion to pursue bill.com as our way to pay our pension vendors. I don't know how more specific the motion needs to be than that.
Second it.
Okay, seconded. Any discussion on that motion? Okay, hearing none and seeing no hands, I'll go ahead and do a roll call vote just because it's tough to see people. So I'll start off with Christina. Shoot.
Aye.
Aurora Jackson.
Aye.
Stephen Yett.
Yep.
John Hampton. Aye. He said aye if he didn't hear. Bill Bradley. Aye. John Hunt. Excused. So the motion passes. So keep us updated on the progress, and I'll look forward to seeing the interface when it comes around.
We'll get it set up.
Thank you. All right, looks like you got some more things here.
Looks like we have certifications. I do have, I know we used to have someone that would help us get all these certifications that I have trouble tracking down. I do have two that are causing me some concern. One, I haven't had an actual science certification for 2 years. Nothing's really changed. I've kind of went back in his file. I don't know how he fell through the cracks last year, but he just kind of did. So he's local. I do a lot. We do lifestatus360.com, which will, you know, pull any deaths or those kinds of things in, but this person I haven't heard from for a while. And the other person moved from one living assistance place to another. I have the daughter's contact information, but the daughter seems to not be giving me an updated address. I know she's in an assisted living home, so I don't know how, you know. So those are two concerning things for me. I don't know if somebody wants to take charge of, you know, contacting these people, or I can send an email with a list if you guys want. I just kind of need some direction.
You know, I think if you send us an email, then maybe with our collective resources here, we can discuss how we want to tackle those. You know, obviously in the days of a pandemic, you're not knocking on people's doors very often.
Right.
So it's definitely unique on how we want to track these folks down. But sometimes it just takes the right angle to get, you know, what we need. And
right.
I think we can figure that out.
Yeah. I know there's a couple of them, probably about three off the top of my head, that send the certification back every year with a long commentary about how unnecessary it is. So I know that three on the list are those type of people, and they're probably just really annoyed by it. But again, you know, it's something that kind of came into play. So I'll go ahead and send that list out to you, Bill.
Thank you.
And then we've got a cash flow discussion. For the ATU, I sent that out as well in a previous email. We are getting down to a point, especially in this past month in August, because of the fact that I believe it has something to do with the board and the funding, and it slows down on some cash flow coming in. But we are recommending a transfer of $750,000 from the investment into the cash.
So if you look at the annualized column in that cash flow, it's projecting the cash getting down to about $22,000 at the end of the year if we did no transfers at all. Average monthly distributions year to date show at 206,000, but with all of the retirees in the last couple of months, we're actually running about 240,000 a month in distributions. And so that 750 was based on just making sure we're keeping 3 months of payroll basically in the checking account. You know, if we want to move that, it might play into Ian's current overweight in our equities, and maybe that's where the cash comes from, but you guys can decide that part of it.
Yeah, I was thinking about that, Dean. Thanks for mentioning that as a way of a rebalance and then filling up the account again. It might be an opportune time to do two birds, one stone kind of situation. I would like to see or hear Ian's commentary on that idea.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great idea. If there's a, Dean, if there's an estimated, you know, figure that you could provide to me, you know, where you'd like to have that balance be, you know, as we approach year end, that's something I can definitely take into consideration when providing a recommendation on a rebalancing analysis. But I would agree that that's probably a pretty opportune time to do it, is when we do initiate that rebalance, which is looking like we're probably headed that way, you know, at some point.
Right.
Would you want this transfer to occur just at one time, or would you want to do it over a couple of weeks so it's not a timing related event?
Yeah, it probably depends. That's why it'd be great to get whatever figure you'd like to have in the checking account by the end of the year. You know, if it's something that's a materially large percentage of the portfolio, then yeah, we'd certainly want to do it over a couple of transitions. But if it's something that we can do within one rebalance of the portfolio and it's not a meaningful percentage of assets, then we could potentially do it in one transfer. So again, if Dean, if you can just let me know that figure at some point, I think then I can probably pull together what our best recommendation would be with respect to that.
Okay, I will do that, and I'll email you and copy the trustee.
Okay, so what I heard is gonna happen is Dean, you're gonna give the figure you need to Ian. Ian's gonna do some calculations and put forward a recommendation for the trustees to do via email in the meantime, potentially?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Well, that's, thanks for doing that, guys. Keep an eye on that. Any other remaining items from the administrators?
Nope, I think that concludes our report.
All right, thank you, Sarah. We got new and unfinished business. I'll take the first one there. 3% COLA increase, and that's on a work stoppage. So there, we haven't pursued that one bit. We definitely had a lot more other things on our plate. One of the things that was getting in the way of that has been settled, so I would like maybe David to speak to that in terms of the part two of the retirement and the fund. We created some new funds out of VALIC there, lower fees.
Right. So it seems like now it's been a while ago, but I think it was middle of last month, VALIC set up our new platform, and you know, all the funds were transferred over to those. Again, they are lower fees for our employees to put their deferred comp, their 401As in those funds. And I think, and maybe it's because of so much other stuff that's going on, I did not hear anything from anybody. And usually, you know, it seems like, you know, you get some feedback from at least that one person that's, you know, watching all of their things ultra closely. But nobody even reached out and said, you know, what is this? Why are we doing this? So I was kind of surprised there. But so that has taken place. I think the only thing that really that the deferred comp committee, which is really part of this and this group, wanting to add the IRA portion.
Raw 457.
Raw, that's what I meant. Sorry, thank you, Bill. So I think that went really well. Into this work group, we just need to now, I think, start rescheduling schedule some meetings.
Yeah, I did get two comments from members, one operator, one a maintenance workers, and they were both positive. So that's pretty rare. I was taking a feather in the cap on that one. So about good.
I was a little worried just because by the time we got everything, it was pretty short on when they were going to make the transfer and what folks could do. And so, so that's good. The only feedback was positive. So.
Yeah, and I logged in and I went and looked at the mapping that they did for my personal funds, and everything seemed appropriate. So hopefully everybody else had the same experience. But I know Brent, our Valak rep, was reaching out to all the members to say, hey, let's sit down and talk about this new lineup, and gave everybody that opportunity. So he put in the hard work on that too. So I do appreciate that. Even though he's not here, he knows I appreciate it. So open for discussion. I have an item, but I'll entertain anything else that anybody else might have. All right. I don't see anything. Oh, David.
Bill, I do have one thing, but I don't know if you want to do yours first or no. So one of the things that I wanted to bring up, and we've talked about this over the years, prior to me even really being, coming to the pension trust meetings, and that is kind of the public meeting laws. And this meeting actually is a public meeting. And I know that we've had some different discussions along that, but, our clerk of the board has worked with our other labor counsel and or our other attorneys, and it does fall under that because this group does provide direction to the board of directors. And so the only real difference that makes is that we need to get the materials for this meeting 10 days prior to the meeting so that we can get it posted and up on our website. And then I guess what that would mean then is, like Sarah's request for agenda items and materials would probably, go out maybe a week before that. So, maybe Sarah's request would go out 17 days prior to what the meeting is. And at that 10-day mark, all the material is in so that we can get it posted up on our website. So again, not a huge change. The one thing I could see is it may be with the dates that we've been picking, it might make with Ian's when he's going to get his material. I think that's really probably what we want to kind of, when he would have that material to be able to send in, is kind of then picking the date from that as I struggle through that statement. Sorry.
Yeah, I think it is a public meeting. We've allowed members of the public, mainly they have been retirees attending the meeting. But I think, early on there was some hesitancy, but it has worked well. I don't see anything really stopping us from going along with that interpretation. So, that's fine with us. And as long as everybody can meet those timelines, I think this continues to be a success. So
I will make sure to meet those timelines.
And I guess it hinges on Ian, and you usually have a lot of data to condense.
Yeah, I think as long as, I'm thinking about this meeting, would we have been able to meet 10 days? And, I sent you guys all the reports 7 days ahead of time, and I don't see, there wouldn't have been a problem this time around. So as long as it falls about, this far out of the previous quarter end, I think generally, like we, you know, like for your portfolio, I get the information plenty ahead of time. It's usually waiting on all the peer comparisons that, that compile into the report to make sure that, and when that final data gets cut, it, it reflects the most robust peer group. So as long as it's, I guess, long story short, as long as we're about, you know, right now we're a little less than 2 months out. So I would say as long as we're probably at least 45 days or so out of the previous quarter end, I don't see any reason why I shouldn't be able to make 10 days for materials.
Okay. Well, that would put us, you know, mid-November now. So I know as long as we don't go too late November for the next meeting, which, you know, is always a challenge for the holidays. Okay. Thank you, David, for that. Then I had a thing. We have our annual pension education that was canceled due to COVID-19. They have offered just to make it a straight transfer to 2021 for the registration and the hotel deposit. So that's pretty simple. But the one thing I would put out there to the rest of the trustees and maybe even the administrator, David, local administrator, I would love to have you there, Sarah, as well. But is the next conference is in Denver. It's super close. It's a direct flight. I think it's in September or October next year, 2021. And, you know, we've gone sometimes as a group of trustees, labor and management, to more local conferences. San Diego rings a bell. So I would just put an invite out to the rest of the trustees that sometimes pass on this education. It's always relevant. It's always interesting. You learn something new. And I think it helps spark better conversations than we have in our day-to-day. So I would just want to put that on your radars, that is an opportunity that's out there that I think is worthy of pursuit. It might, you know, this year it might be a little light on expenses just because we're not doing it. Next year, maybe a little heavy and even out. So, that's all I had for an update on the, in terms of the education. I know they're doing a virtual thing. I was going to inspect what that meant and how that was being presented. So there, if we wanted to do virtual, there might be an additional cost to that, but we'd circle back on whether that was prudent or not. That's all I had as an update. I can email you guys that information about 2021 Denver's U.S. Annual Convention. So date and time and place of next meeting. I know usually our most complicated trustee on our side isn't here, and you know that's will make it easy to schedule for us. So we're looking at mid-November, which is tricky, but let's see what we can do. Let's see, the 21st or 2nd November, is that too late? I want to give Ian as much time as possible. That's why I was pushing.
That's a Saturday and a Sunday.
Ah, that's in October.
So I'm looking at the week of the 16th, which is a Monday. The week of the 23rd, which is the following week, is Thanksgiving.
Okay, so the 18th or 19th then.
19th works best.
Yeah, I was going to say the 19th. I can't do the 18th, but I could do the 19th.
Okay.
19th works the best for me as well.
Great. 19th works for me.
Work for me. I can make the 19th work.
Wonderful. The 10 a.m. time slot, Zoom, presumably. You know, who knows? But I'd imagine it's probably Zoom. And I think that all continues to hold true. So date and time, place next meeting will be November 19th at 10 a.m. via Zoom video conferencing. So with nothing else, I'll end the meeting. Thank you everybody for being there and good luck at your next meeting. I hope it's as entertaining as this one.
Thanks, Bill.
Thanks, Bill.
So can you guys hear me?
Yep.
Yep. Okay. So I'm going to bring up the agenda and share my screen. Can you see the agenda?
Yep.
Okay, good. So I will start the meeting. The first one is looking at the minutes of the May 13, 2020 meeting and making sure that everybody is okay with making a motion to accept those meeting minutes. Does anybody have any changes to the minutes of the May 13 meeting?
I didn't see any, Christina, but I moved to approve.
Okay, awesome. I second. I'm sorry, what's that? Okay, all in favor of accepting those meeting minutes? AJ?
Yes.
Steven? All right. And then the report of the investment consultant, Ian.
All right. So I similar to previous meetings, same comments go for the salary plan as to the union plan. We're probably in about the same range. Well, I know we are about the same range with respect to overweights on the domestic equity side versus fixed income. So, the only additional comment I'd have is, you know, depending on what Sarah and Dean say within their section regarding cash flow needs, we'll probably want to initiate a rebalance in this plan. At the same time, we do the union plan, but if there's no need for additional cash flow buffer into the salary plan checking, then we can simply just do the rebalance within the plan. So I'll wait obviously till Dean and Sarah's section to discuss that, but that would be the only caveat is everything else applies the same thing in terms of performance and in terms of the asset allocation versus where it sits for target.
Great, thank you. Does anybody have any questions for Ian? Okay, so then the next item is the report of the actuary.
All right, and this one will be similarly kind of short as in the prior meeting. Where we're at the moment, we've got, you know, our usual annual benefit statement and GASB accounting work that we're getting going on. But just wanted to give a quick update on the funded status for this plan, for the salary plan relative to, you know, July 1, 2019. As trustees know, adopted lower discount rate, 5.5%. At that time on a market value basis, it was about 67% funded when measured that way. And with all the, you know, the good second half of 2019 and then the really roller coaster first half of 2020, we're actually back to just about the same spot, about 67% funded middle of the year here on the salary plan. So again, this is for this plan, it's halfway through the 2-year rate setting cycle. So we'll see what this next year brings before we are, updating contribution rates for the next 2-year period. pause there if there's any questions on anything of it. Lacey and I'd be happy to address, but that's all we have for now.
Thank you. So will that proposal be in the November meeting? Contribution rate to the salaries plan?
No, that'll be, so that'll be after we do the July 1, 2021 valuation. So we did the 2019, and then since it's the biannual valuation, we'll do the 2021, and then would have the updated contribution rates off of that valuation for the subsequent fiscal year starting in 2022.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
So the next on the agenda is the report of the attorney.
So my first agenda item is the appointment of a vice chair. This relates to the investment policy statement that was adopted in May. In order to keep the language between the salary plan and the ATU plan IPS the same, the ATU plan called for the chair to have certain powers to make investment decisions, but if the chair isn't available, then the vice chair does. And what this group decided last time was to keep that language the same, but to appoint a vice chair. Right now there isn't a vice chair appointed. So the purpose of this agenda item is to have the trustees appoint a vice chair so that if that power in the investment policy statement is needed, there's a vice chair to actually make the decision.
Okay, does that mean or anybody want to propose who would like to be vice chair or recommend somebody as vice chair among the three of us?
I move if Stephen accepts for him to be the vice chair. If he doesn't, then I'll volunteer. But I just think since you're a staff and just to have a good balance, but definitely that's contingent on Stephen's acceptance.
That's an awful lot of responsibility. I'm not sure I can handle it, AJ, but under the circumstances, I think my thin shoulders will manage and I'll accept. Thank you.
Thank you, Stephen. So I'll make a motion then that Stephen Yet be appointed as the vice chair.
Second.
So thank you. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Stephen?
I guess I say aye, but isn't that a conflict of interest?
No. It doesn't benefit you, Stephen. It's a second.
Okay, I'll take it then. Second.
Awesome. The motion passes.
Great. So my second item, I guess I would prefer to bump it really, it makes sense to bump it till the end, I think, because to the Kernit Stokes and others on the call aren't really needed for the executive session, and I think it will take some time, and so it probably is easier to deal with the administrator's report first and then to come back to the executive session.
Okay, sounds good. So let's move on then, and we'll come back to the executive session and move on to the administrator's report.
All right, so again, the expenses, I guess I have the cash flow first, huh? So we are recommending that looks without contributions, without transfers of any monies or contribution, or without the increase in contributions, we're looking at, a cash balance of approximately at the end of the year, $129,000. So again, we're getting down to just having just that one ability to pay one payment with the retirements that are happening. We are recommending balance transfer of about $375,000 in order to keep the 3 months of payments in the cash account.
Okay, and I believe that Ian recommended that we do that at the same time as we do the ATU as well.
And I will do the same thing here that I was going to do with the ATU plan, which is sort of project out the cash flows every single month here for the rest of the year. And when it is imperative that we have money, it's so that Ian can decide if we want to do it in steps prior to that date or all at that date or something like that.
Yeah,
okay,
thanks,
Scott,
so
you and Ian.
Oh, I'm sorry. Ahead, what?
Sorry, my apologies, Christina.
Please go ahead.
Okay, I was just going to say, Dean, so you said 375 is needed to transfer. Yeah, if you could just let me know. For both the union and salaried plans, you know, the amount necessary to where you'd want to have it at like a certain point or a certain date and time. That way we can kind of, I can keep that in mind in terms of when the rebalance might happen. You know, if for example, the cash is needed before we would normally do a rebalance, we can certainly do some kind of a rebalance on the interim to make sure that thing is funded to where it should be. So yeah, if you could just give me some kind of projections for both plans on when and what cash is needed at what point in time, all then kind of back into when that rebalance likely should take place.
Okay, perfect.
Thank you, Ian.
Okay, and with the expenses and retirees, I set those out prior to the meeting. Nothing looks out of the ordinary, all pretty typical monthly expenses. The retirees are getting more and more. So we did have, four or five in the month of May. And then we do have that, we have one specific retiree that is getting a lump sum payment. And at this point, we can't really pay her until we can do some transfer of funds because it is such a large payment. It's approximately about $54,000 to that one retiree. But that's just the lump sum payment. And then going forward, it's just a couple hundred dollars. So.
And Sarah, is there, what is the legal, or Jeff, what is the legal requirement for paying that out? I mean, timing wise.
I'm not sure I know the answer to that question.
I think, It seems like it would put the plan in a hardship position to pay that out immediately. So I think that putting that plan in a hardship position in order to pay this out would be kind of...
So I'll put together the projected cash flows and I'll note the amount of that one lump sum payment and include that in what I give to Ian. So Ian can take a look at that. And I think it probably makes, if we don't have an obligation to pay it today, like if we can pay it sometime in the next 2 to 3 months, Jeff, then I think coordinating with Ian on what makes the most sense from transferring the investments to cash will play into when we make that payment.
That makes sense. As long as we fit legally, I guess I don't know what the legal requirement is to make sure that we pay by a certain time because I wouldn't want to miss that deadline.
Can I jump in for a second, please?
Thank you, Stephen.
I think you ask a very good question, Christina. So, Jeff, I'd like to know what's our legal time frame. And then secondly, I'd like to know when this employee, or now former employee, needs these funds. Because if they have some pressing need, I certainly would like to meet that, if possible. And I think the hardship for the fund is certainly something to keep in mind. But that's not the employee's problem. That's our problem. And if we just have to honor whatever our legal obligation is first, and then secondly, if we can, whenever that employee needs the money, or at least would like the money.
Can I say something just really quick, just so you know, Stephen? So this employee left the district in 2007. At that point, I believe they were 57. So at age 60, they became eligible for their benefit, which was 2010. And then they actually, and I had actually in this situation, because it was a former HR employee, I had emailed them prior to their 60th birthday saying, hey, you know, you need to fill out the application. I actually ran into them probably a year or so later and said, hey, I still haven't seen that. And this was, you know, I ran into them like on a Saturday at Macy's or, you know, and they're like, well, I'm still looking for something. And then earlier this year, they reached out and we got them another application. And so the reason, obviously, you probably figured out based on Sarah's comment that it's, I think it's a $400 and some benefit, but it's 10 years retro at this point in time. So I totally understand, you know, I mean, if they need it, I mean, that is a different thing, but they definitely have also put this off for a little bit. I guess one of my questions would also be is if we can at least get them, start getting them their monthly benefit. But obviously, you know, to the question to Jeff is what are our legal requirements? So I just wanted to give you that history.
Thank you. That's very helpful. So they dropped the ball to a certain extent. I agree with you. If we can get them their monthly installment, that's helpful. And then I guess I just defer to Jeff on what must we do legally within the time frame, and we do our best to honor that.
And I can do that. I just can't do that right now.
In that spare bedroom, you can't answer that question right now?
Correct.
So I'll just say that we will work with Jeff to find out the legal requirements, and we will get the payments ASAP as soon as we possibly can get them going for her.
Okay, and then also project, we're also doing the projection to know the timing of what we need to do to make sure that there's funds in the account.
Correct.
Okay, awesome. Thank you.
And then again, our last item would be that bill.com item to see if the salaried trustees wanted to go for that platform as well.
Can we just jump to yes?
So do you want to make a motion, Stephen?
I motion that we go to bill.com yesterday. Thank you.
I second. All in favor?
Aye.
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 Thank okay, you. We will go ahead and get that started for you.
Excellent. Thank you so much. So before we go into executive session, is there any new or unfinished business that we want to talk about? Does anybody have any other topics that we didn't discuss that they would like to discuss?
None for me.
The next meeting, I assume, just follows ATU as normal.
Excellent, yes.
The only thing I would say is, again, the same thing that I made the request as far as the 10 days prior and everything. I realize I'm talking to the same group, but I thought it was only fair to mention it here too.
I'll respond and say, yes, we'll try and get that to you within 17 days of the meeting.
Thanks for the reminder,
10 days
for
the material, 17 days for the request, I think. Well, and that gives you the, you know, a week.
Excellent. So I will close this meeting and open up our executive session. So those who do not need to be in the executive session can leave. So thank you very much for being here and for sharing your expertise, and have a wonderful day and stay healthy and well.
Thank you. You too.
Thank you guys. Have a great meeting.
Thank you, everybody. Bye.
Bye.
So Christina, the first order of business is to announce the executive session under 192.662(8) to consult with counsel concerning the legal rights and duties of a public body with regard to current litigation or litigation likely to be filed. So if you just say that that's the basis for executive session, then we can go into executive session.
Okay, I will, that we opened the executive session and for, I don't think I remember all those numbers that you just gave me.
Sure, no, if you just say on that basis, then that'll be fine.
Oh, on that basis, thank you. That's much easier.
Great, so let's see, this'll take a little bit of time to set the stage, and I'll talk for just a little bit, and then I think David will have an actual example so that these words that I'm going to flood you with, which maybe sound theoretical, will be put in a practical term. So that'll give a good basis for our decision. So an issue has arisen with some terminated vested members. So these are people who terminate employment with at least 5 years of service. And the issue arises out of a 2000.
Jeff, can I interrupt for just a second? Procedural point on the executive session. Do the committee members still want the recording to continue or not?
No, that's a good point. I think the recording should not continue unless the clerk of the board tells me that it has to.
I believe we're not taking minutes on it, so we do the recording one or the other. I know we started for executive sessions, Jeff, like forwarding that portion like to the attorney present so that it's protected. But I believe there's some requirement. Camille, are you listening in? She might not be listening in.
I think she wasn't going to listen in. I'm texting her right now.
Okay.
Yeah, and sorry to interrupt. Just wanted to make sure, I know people can handle that differently. So.
And I know David is going to take minutes for this part, which can be kept separately from the usual minutes, which I think I would prefer to the recording.
So I believe it is being recorded right now, right? Because no one stopped recording. So,
right.
And Jeff, you said you prefer that it be recorded, and AJ said that it's protected. So I believe we can continue.
Oh. I had tried to say that I prefer that.
Camille says it needs to be recorded. So.
Okay.
That makes it easy then. Okay. So the issue regarding these terminated vested arises out of a 2009 plan amendment that increased normal retirement age from age 60 to age 62. And this issue is most significant for seven terminated vested members, who have about $110,000 at stake for possible lost benefits between the times they attained age 60 and the time they attained age 62. And so now I'll give you some kind of in-depth plan background. It's a complicated issue, and I will try to make it as easy to understand as possible. And it's very possible that Scott or Lacey might be able to chime in and make what is jumbled a little complicated in my mind easy, but this is as good as I could do. So terminated vested members become eligible for unreduced early retirement benefits at age 60. And if they don't elect early retirement benefits, then their benefits start at the normal retirement age of 62. Now, if they elect benefits after normal retirement age, the benefits are paid retroactive to the normal retirement age of 62. So if they elect benefits at 65, they get benefits retroactive to age 62. So they don't lose benefits by failing to apply for a benefit right when they attain normal retirement. Conversely, for early retirement benefits, they're not paid retroactively. So members lose benefits each month they fail to apply for benefits between age 60, when their benefits are no longer reduced, and age 62. So for example, a member who's entitled to $1,000 each month beginning at age 60, who starts benefits 3 months late, they lose $3,000, and they'll keep losing that $1,000 each month until they reach the normal retirement age of 62. So they could lose up to 24 monthly payments. And in the vast majority of these cases, maybe in every case, it's, in my mind, sort of irrational for the terminated vested member not to start early retirement benefits right when they attain age 60, because they forego those payments and they get no additional benefit. So terminated vested members receive a vesting certificate at the time they terminate employment with LTD. In its current form, the vesting certificate doesn't clearly tell employees the consequences of failing to apply for the early retirement benefit at age 60. And in addition, LTD has not generally tried to track down those terminated vested members as they approach age 60. And with discussions with Scott and Lacey and David, my recommendation is that going forward, administrative practices be changed to more clearly inform members of the consequences of delaying early retirement benefits after age 60. In other words, just make very clear that they're going to lose benefits if they don't elect them at age 60, and to try to contact these members shortly before age 60 to give them election forms. But there are 7 terminated vested members who have already lost benefits totaling about $110,000 because they haven't applied for benefits at age 60. And that raises the question, what, if anything, the trustees want to do about payments they've lost from age 60. So there's 2 categories of members to be concerned about. There's terminated vested members who received an incorrect vesting certificate. And then there's terminated vested members who receive a correct vesting certificate. So with regard to category 1, some terminated vested participants received a vesting certificate that incorrectly showed a normal retirement date based on age 60, when in fact their normal retirement date was age 62. And Susan Dreyer, formerly Susan Quick, is one example, and David's gonna talk about her specific situation when I'm done. So under the current plan, these members will lose up to 24 monthly benefits if they fail to start their benefits at age 60. There are about 20 members in this category, six of whom have missed all or some of their unreduced early retirement benefits back to age 60. And the sum of all those missed early retirement benefits for those six members is about $100,000. Then the second category of members falling in this, who this situation arises with, are the terminated vested participants who receive a correct vesting certificate showing correctly that their normal retirement date is age 62. There are about six of these members, of whom one has missed some or all of the unreduced early retirement benefit. And the sum for that one participant is $10,000. So for members going forward who haven't yet hit age 60, we can change our administrative practices and let them know the consequences of failing to elect benefits at age 60. But for these seven, those lost, they've already hit 60 and they've already started losing benefits. So with regard to those seven, here's what I see the options are. We can amend the plan to give those seven terminated vested members who've lost benefits an election to start benefits immediately. And then those who do elect will get a lump sum going back to the date they started, they attained age 60 and started losing benefits. A second option would be to amend the plan in that way for the six members who received an incorrect vesting certificate, but not to do that for the member who received the correct vesting certificate. And then the third option is not to do any of that, not to do anything different, and not to make retroactive payments back to when these seven attained age 60. And that alternative has some legal risks should a member seek retroactive payments. And the chief risks that I see are, first, a claim for breach of fiduciary duty for the trustees failing to inform the participants that they'd lose money if they don't elect to start benefits when they attain age 60. I don't know that claim for breach of fiduciary duty would succeed, but I think that it has a good chance of succeeding because we have to operate the plan for the benefit of participants and not telling somebody that if they don't elect the benefit, they're gonna lose it, I think makes it hard to say we're operating the plan for their benefit. And then the second possible claim is an impairment of contracts claim that the plan improperly took away a right they had to retroactive payments between age 60 and 62. So again, at normal retirement age, if you don't elect right when you attain normal retirement age, you can get your benefit retroactive to normal retirement age. Well, what the plan did when it switched normal retirement age from 60 to 62 was they took away the right, quote unquote, for these participants to get their benefit retroactive to age 60. And I think that there's at least some possibility that violates their contract rights and is impermissible. And I think both of those claims exist for all seven members, including the member who received the correct testing certificate. So I think these claims are a little stronger for the members who received the incorrect vesting certificate, but they don't disappear for this individual who got the correct vesting certificate. So that I hope sets out the background in a reasonably coherent way and the options. But David, maybe if you can talk about Susan Dreyer, then we'll put a specific fact on it.
I can do that. And I guess the one thing I would say, or maybe two points that I might bring up based on our conversation the other day. One was, it was November of 2009 that the plan changed the normal retirement age from age 60 to age 62. And just so you know, Sue Dreyer left in January of 2010. The other thing I guess I thought that was also relevant, Jeff, to what you were stating is the email from Everett, who was the pension attorney at the time, that's stated that there was, that the, if I understood this correctly the other day, that the idea was to not have any significant change to the plan or the benefits. Am I stating that correctly?
Yeah, I mean, it's been hard to piece together exactly what was going on when that normal retirement age changed, but there is indication, and I think that the litigation issues that I mentioned also support the idea that when there was a change in normal retirement from age 60 to age 62, the plan was attempting to hold everyone harmless by giving an early retirement benefit unreduced back to age 60. And that they are held harmless if they elect benefits right when they turn age 60. But because of this retroactivity issue, they're not held harmless if they don't elect their early retirement benefit right when they turn age 60. And that's the category of people that we're talking about here.
And so then the information on Ms. Dreyer. So I'm trying to think. I reached out to her because of her, she also had her ATU pension, and was sending her the information. And on the ATU pension, just so you know, the pension statements that continue to go out to folks that have left and are vested, you know, terminated and are vested, clearly states on them, on the back page of it, that, you know, if you miss, you know, that age 60, I mean, you don't go back. It's not retroactive. It is from the date, you know, that you apply going forward. And I did point that out to her. However, I did tell her that that her salary plan would actually go back to age 60, and I based that on the current situation with the pension that we were talking about with the person that has the retro of roughly $54,000, and that one was going back to age 60, and not realizing, which, you know, that that retirement age had changed right in that time frame. But again, we've never had a mechanism to reach out to folks ahead of time and let them know. And again, they get that statement when they leave. The vesting certificate shortly after they leave, we inform them that they should contact LTD at age 60. But again, you know, if somebody leaves at age, you know, 40 or 45, you know, then it's, I mean, you know, that's 15, 20 years, and it's probably not reasonable to expect them to remember that conversation. So I hope that that gives you a little more clarity.
So the upshot is that we have this population of seven people who have a right to benefits starting at age 60 that is as great as they're ever going to get. These people haven't collected benefits. They weren't contacted about starting benefits. Some of them received information that would indicate that their normal retirement age was 60, which would imply retroactive benefits if you put two and two together under the plan. And so there's about $110,000 of benefits that these people have lost so far, and the trustees now have to decide what to do about that. I guess, Scott and Lacey, do you have clarifying remarks to help the trustees here?
I might start, and then if Lacey has anything to add, but I think that's a really good summary. Just for the trustees' awareness, the decision for a vested terminated participant, they can start earlier than 60 with a benefit that is then incrementally reduced below that starting value at age 60. And that may be a good choice for plenty of participants. They may actually want to start below 60. The new, what Jeff was calling sort of the corrected vested statements, the vesting certificates we give out sort of ever since this change, kind of shortly after Ms. Dreyer, I believe, they got updated to reflect the change. They list three dates. They list the normal retirement date of 62. They list the earliest possible retirement age of 55 and spell out how the reductions work. And they list the unreduced at 60. So the dates are all there. I think, you know, from this conversation, whatever happens with this conversation, it would be a great idea to beef up the language on that, because it is, it's clearly, as Jeff laid out, in everyone's financial interest to start no later than 60. At that point, there's no reason to wait, since it's not reduced at that point. So that's kind of the situation going forward. But as he laid out for the, you know, for these seven, who six of whom left in a time frame when they didn't get that updated statement. So it told them that their normal retirement age was 60, which, you know, you still might hope they would come back and start it on time, but the consequence if they don't was less dire, because in that situation they would have gotten retro back to 60, but these individuals, as the plan sets out right now, don't. So I'll stop there. Lacey, anything else worth adding?
The only thing I would add is that we're happy to revise the annual statement language for actives, or provide more detail on the vesting certificates. And then also we can be helpful in finding these vested terminated folks who may have moved away or have lost contact with the district. I'm sure they're not all great at providing future addresses after they leave employment, but that's something we very commonly do for clients. So we would be happy to help if that's needed as well.
So trustees, are you following with the situation here and the issue?
Yes. So AJ and Steven, do you have any questions or comments based on what Jeff and David, Lacey and Scott have outlined here?
I can begin. So before I can, you know, I'm trying to sort my thoughts out about, you know, what to do with the potential liability we have there. Before that, it sounds to me, and I just want to get confirmation, is it my understanding that we have corrected, that this was an error that happened, you know, back in 2009, that we have found out about it, you know, now, and that we've already, even before finding out, have taken all the steps to prevent this from happening again, correct? Like, Or is this still an issue we're going to have to address? How do we prevent this from happening again?
Well, we won't have to. We've sort of talked before this meeting and at this meeting about changing procedures going forward so that it's crystal clear to terminated vested participants as they're approaching age 60. They will know that if they don't elect benefits right at age 60, they're going to be losing benefits. And so they might really want to start benefits at age 60. And so going forward, we know we can communicate with these people and maybe prevent situations where they don't elect starting at age 60. But with regard to these seven people following in this who have already started losing benefits from age 60, you know, it was kind of a combination of the change in the plan and then they're attaining age 60 and then the vesting certificate having been wrong and they're not electing benefits. So it took a whole bunch of steps to arrive at these seven people who fall in this category of lost benefits.
Correct, but going forward, I guess my question is there a downside to the trust? So like you're saying, if somebody delays accepting benefits, they then lose that. So then it puts a lot of responsibility on us to contact that person, right? And within the time that they left to the time that they're eligible, it could be over 10 years, just like it is now. And, you know, we could lose track of them. Do we have to have a penalty in there? I mean, why do we have this penalty in there that puts so much responsibility on us? If we're not paying them a benefit and the money is in our hands, why are we penalizing that person? Like, are we able to change that? I mean, I'm not sure what the benefit to the trust is. I mean, a person delaying, why are they being harmed?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, we don't harm them once they've attained normal retirement age. And so that if, for example, they don't elect benefits until they're 65, nevertheless, their benefit is going to be retroactive to age 62. That is not the same for early retirement. And I think that typically it's early retirement benefits are not typically paid retroactive to when they become unreduced. The plan could be amended that way. That is certainly an option. We could amend the plan to provide that any benefit elected after attaining age 60 will be paid retroactive to age 60. To the extent the trust is harmed, it's only harmed in the sense that it's having to kind of keep in mind that this person might wind up being entitled to a big lump sum if they don't elect benefits, say, until they're age 70, and then all of a sudden the trust has to pay a benefit in a lump sum of 10 years worth of benefits. So I think maybe because of that, plans don't typically pay early retirement benefits retroactively, but the plan already does that for normal retirement age. So does that answer your question?
I think it does. I'm just trying to understand how we prevent this from being so complicated, both to the employee and to us. It almost seems like there has to be an easier way. I mean, this is, you know, if somebody started collecting early retirement benefits and then they turn 70, they've been collecting early retirement benefits. The only difference in this case is that we would have been paying them. I mean, the real risk is to the person who could die in between there, right? I mean, they, and if they don't have a bed, I mean, the risk is on the participant, on the retired employee. The risk is not on the plan. Because anybody who's reached that age that could be eligible, if we account for that and say, you know, we have 7 outstanding members that could be eligible. So because of that, we always calculate that any one of these 7 people could have returned. And so this is money. Now, if they don't return, the money then becomes part of the trust. So there's actually a benefit to the trust in keeping that in there, is there not?
I mean, I think that the way you're thinking about it, it sounds to me basically right, that these people are entitled to this benefit starting at age 60. And if we tell them, one thing we can do is just amend the plan to say whenever they start electing, they're going to get their benefit retroactive to age 60. Another thing we could do is not do that, but just make sure that we let them know ahead of time, you might really want to start benefits at age 60, because if you don't, you're going to lose benefits. Here's an election form. And then if they don't elect benefits, it's on them. It's not going to be retroactive to age 60.
I also think,
right, I think it needs to be something like that. Either we go one way or the other, but this in-between messy piece appears that it does not benefit the trust and it does not benefit the payee either.
I think, AJ, part of it, so I believe it was, if I'm not mistaken, around up until, I think it was 99, and somebody else can correct me if I'm wrong, but right around in there, the normal retirement age was age 62. And then it changed to age 60. And then in at the end of 2009, it was changed back to age 62, but again, with this unreduced benefit at age 60, if somebody collected. But I think if we, and what I was kind of hearing you maybe say, is if we treat these, you know, 6 or 7, get them taken care of, and maybe I misunderstood what you were saying, AJ, but this is what it sounded like to me, but we pay them their retro. And then I think, you know, then either going forward, we could just say, okay, at age 60, you know, we're going to do retro. I mean, even if they come back at age 70, or we can make it clear that the retirement age is age 60. Your normal retirement age is age 62, but you could get unreduced benefits at age 60. And then if they, you know, if they don't, it's not retroactive, but I guess it would still be retroactive to age 62. Correct. Yeah. So,
I think that's a very good summary. Definitely. I welcome Christina's and Stephen's thought, but definitely I support a more streamlined and clear way of doing this.
Stephen, do you have any thoughts? So I have a question based on what AJ said. If we did what she suggested, what happens if the person doesn't actually claim their benefits? And they pass, does the benefits, are their beneficiaries qualified to come after the plan for benefits not paid out?
Yes, I would need to look at that to see. You know, I think clearly if the person doesn't have beneficiaries and dies without ever having elected benefits, I think the plan would retain the benefit, is my guess. The benefit would just disappear But if they have beneficiaries and they die and they haven't elected, I would need to look at the plan to see what happens with that benefit.
So if I'm understanding AJ's suggestion that David summarized, she's basically suggesting that we treat it the same. Is that correct? Regardless of whether it's I guess which I think she's saying is that we would pay the seven people out, and then in addition to that, we would change the plan going forward so that it's more simple and that it treats everybody the same from a retroactive standpoint. Is that correct? Is that, or did I misunderstand?
I don't know the answer to that. I don't know that AJ's statement took a position on whether either the plan is amended to always pay retroactive to age 60 or we just do a better job of contacting these future people as they attain age 60.
Well, my concern is, and I think Christina kind of half that, David kind of said, I think we do need to correct the errors that were made retroactively for the individuals, but I think going forward, I think I support more what David said, is to make it very clear you're eligible at 60, but you know, but if you don't collect 62, we will not go back after we've made it very clear. What I don't want is going forward, we will do a better job. I think unless we have a very clear process on how that is accomplished successfully, I think that's more of a hope and a wish, because most of us will not be here in 5 years, 10 years to make that hopeful commitment on part of the district. I don't think that's fair to the district, because that's kind of what we're doing today. We're fixing a 10-year-old error for people probably at that point who were hopeful that we as a district would do a better job. And of course we didn't do a better job. So I think what we want to do is have really clear processes going forward that are solid, and that we can have, we put the adequate responsibility on the employee, but we do have, or you know, the terminated employee, but we do have a way to retroactively pay them to whatever that commitment we make to them. You know, whatever the commitment we make, that where their benefits begin, that regardless of when they come back, we will pay them. And again, to make sure that we meet our fiduciary duty, whether that's 60 or 62, I'm kind of fuzzy on it, but wherever that is, I believe that we should not harm that employee, wherever we owe them that amount. And if it is 60 and we have the authority back in 2009 to change it to 62, then that's fine. I don't really care about the correct date, as long as it is, well, we have the authority to change it legally.
Okay, so the seven, it sounds like we would go ahead and make them whole. With the plan itself, definitely for anybody who makes a retroactive claim from 62 on, that's the regular retirement that continues to be as it currently is. And then between 60 and 62, between anything before age 62 would be considered early retirement, is what I think I heard. And that anything that's early retirement, we need to make it more clear that you're eligible at age 60 to apply for your full retirement at age 60, and retroactive retirement prior to age 60. Is that correct?
I think that was correct, except for the last statement. And so if I can just try to summarize what I think you said, Christina, it's that we're gonna fix by paying retroactive for the 7 who have already lost benefits. And then going forward, we're going to have clearer administrative procedures and documents to make clear to future people as they approach age 60 that if they don't elect benefits at age 60, those benefits are going to be lost. But we would not amend the plan to pay retroactive to age 60 if they don't elect.
Correct. I yes, that is correct.
Okay, that makes sense.
And that we will have a very clear process on, I mean, on the fact that we, and I don't know if we have a certified letter or, you know, we have some way of getting something to say that anybody who falls under that second criteria was notified and we made contact with them. And once we've completed our obligation, I think we're clear, right?
Well, as I say, I think that there is still an outstanding issue under the contract rights claim that I briefly mentioned, which is complicated. I apologize for that, but you know, they had accrued a bunch of their benefit during a period when normal retirement age was 60, and they had a right to retroactive benefits back to age 60. And then we changed normal retirement age to age 62. And now we're saying we're only paying benefits retroactive to age 62, but this period between 60 and 62, it's not going to be retroactive. And I think there's some risk that is an impairment of contract that if they brought a lawsuit about that, they would win. I think that there's some risk that that's the case. So I can't say there's no risk doing the making the decision that we've talked about making here, where we don't amend the plan to pay retroactive to age 60 in every case. But if we follow the administrative procedures, I think they're likely to elect at age 60 and that issue won't arise. So
let me ask this question. Let me just ask this question. What in essence you're saying that at the time the plan made this decision to change it from 60 to 62, the trustees actually may not have had the legal right to do that. Because what you're saying is that there's, that individuals had already earned, they can claim that they had already earned the right at 60, and then the trustees at that time changed it. So in essence, what you're saying is the trustees did not have the authority or could have or may not have had the authority, and that could be questioned.
That's right. I mean, I think that there was an attempt made in the plan to hold these people harmless from the bump in normal retirement from 60 to 62 by giving them unreduced benefits back to age 60. And if the people elected benefits at age 60, then they were held harmless. And now has arisen this category of people who didn't elect at age 60, and now we revisit and see, well, they're not held harmless by this change from 60 to 62. Was that by design? Was that just, you know, something that fell through the cracks? I don't know the answer to that. But my guess is that if the trustees had thought about it at the time, if my predecessor had thought about it when drafting that amendment, might have taken that into account in drafting the amendment. I don't know. So, and I think it's an open question whether it violates that their contract rights or not. Where I started wanting to jump in was that I can't say for sure that it doesn't violate their contract rights. I think you know, if you're someone who had a right to $1,000 a month at age 60, and you didn't start benefits until age 65, and now they come back and say, well, you can start benefits back to age 62, but not to age 60. And they say, well, I could have gotten benefits retroactive to age 60. How that would play out in a court, even if we told them ahead of time, look, you need to elect benefits starting at age 60 or you're gonna lose them. How a court would decide that issue, I don't know the answer. I think there's a risk that even though we told them you're gonna lose benefits if you don't start at age 60, the member would win because the plan used to give them that retroactive right to age 60.
So I think before we vote on this, I'd like to understand better what the risk to the district is. If we were to say that those individuals, not just the ones that we said, maybe there was an error made, the seven or people we're talking about, but those, that second category of individuals, if we were to say we make them whole back to 60 because that is our risk, I mean, how much money are we talking about? How many people and how much money? Because I think knowing what that is allows us to understand the level of risk we're willing to take on something like this, you know, that we may not even have the authority to have done to begin with. So I really would hate to litigate something that we knew we were not, may not even have had the authority to do it, and we just make it a bigger deal than it needs to. And I think we also, if we think this plan has a risk, we should be budgeting for it, regardless one way or the other, right? We should be accounting for that risk in this plan. So I think I'd like to know that. I don't know if that's available today, but without knowing what that risk is, I don't know, you know, if there's an urgency for us to make a decision today, if there's an urgency for us to make a decision on the seven people we're talking about, I think I'm more prepared to do that. I know the dollar amount, you know, I do have a preference, but I definitely do think that Stephen and Christina, I'm willing to go along with the group as to what we think is the correct way of dealing with those. But as far as the bigger second group, with the 60 and 62 in between, I think I'd like to understand what that liability is before I vote on that piece, unless.
So I agree with you, AJ, and but the problem with deciding on the seven, and I could be wrong, is that then we set a precedent for what we're doing. And so I feel like if we make a decision today on the seven, that we're kind of making a decision on all of the ones that might be outstanding. But I don't know if that's the case. I mean, Jeff could say more about that than I can, but that was my thought.
But the other thing, just really quick, on the other ones besides the seven, they haven't come to, I guess, maturity yet, so they haven't gotten to age 60. So if we implement everything, we're actually going to be, I mean, I think initially, I mean, we're going to be saying, hey, you should fill out this application prior to age 60 and start receiving your benefit. I guess if we kept the age 62, then there's that chance there, like what Jeff was just saying. But again, most of us, I think, would fill out the application and send it in. And I think if we've made, if we work with Milliman, as they've said, send out statements and contact them, then I think that we're actually going to have paid that amount. It's the 60 between the the amount between 60 and 62. Does that make sense? Is that?
It does, and I think that there's, like, the plan gives them unreduced benefits to age 60, and it's in their interest to elect benefits at age 60, and we will make clear that it's in their interest to elect benefits at age 60. So the likelihood is that the vast majority of these people are going to elect benefits at age 60. And that's appropriate. That's what the plan has said they're entitled to. And so there's, in that regard, there's not really a risk to the plan. Where there can wind up being a risk to the plan is where we don't pay retroactive to age 60, and then a member objects and, you know, files some sort of litigation, and we wind up fighting it, and then we wind up losing, and then we pay retroactive to age 60. So I don't think there's a lot of risk to the plan either way. If we do our job right, the people who haven't hit age 60 yet will elect benefits starting at age 60, which is appropriate under the plan.
Right, and just to add on to that, so as far as the liability for this group or anything, I mean, in general, for a vested terminated participant who's 50 or 55 now, we're valuing them and as if they're going to take it at age 60. So that's no change for us from our perspective. We could always come up with a number, which was, you know, if X number of these people didn't, then what's the difference between giving them back to 60 or 62? But I don't know that that's really a meaningful number for you, because as Jeff and David just mentioned, I mean, going forward either way, we're already assuming people are going to take it at 60. Well, there may not be 100% compliance on that. The vast majority should, if this is, being brought to their attention. So we're happy to develop anything that helps the trustees' decision here, but we already really anticipate the liability of them starting at 60 right now.
That's helpful. Thank you very much. That's what I want to make sure we were. Stephen, the last question was, how time sensitive is this? Should we, does this need to be decided today? I mean, I think if Stephen and Christine are prepared, I think I could be prepared as well. I just wanted to make sure that we didn't hold anything up or that Stephen or Christina didn't need any additional information.
To answer the one question as far as the urgency, sorry, Christina. Again, we have Sue Dreyer's application in, and so it would determine whether it starts, September 1st, theoretically, versus, going back to her 60th birthday, which was May, or would have started in June of 19, yeah. So that's the others at this point are in the dark in regards to this conversation. They we just need to start figuring out what we're going to do with them.
I guess the only other point would be maybe just for the exact messaging of the next people who are coming up to their age 60, if we're telling them, you should start, it's in your best interest, or you should start, it's in your best interest, and if you don't, you are just losing money. I think the clarity for David's message there would be the other piece.
Yes, go ahead.
Scott or David or Lacey, there are a few of those coming up to their age 60 fairly soon. Isn't that right? I guess.
Yeah, there's two in October.
Right.
That would start being able to start drawing in October of this year. So.
Okay.
Stephen, do you have any strong feelings one way or the other before you put a motion on? And I'm not sure, he might be having audio problems. I know it's happened in the past.
Nope, I'm good.
Okay.
Thank you, AJ. I'm in alignment with what's been discussed. I think we have to do right by the employees. I don't think that's a question. And as to your fine point, AJ, about let's just make sure we resolve this issue going forward. I'll leave that to David and Jeff to craft the appropriate disclosure that is a five-year-old can understand. And so in case we ever get in a situation to where an employee claims that we did not alert them, and I think this is the legal exposure that Jeff can protect us from, is that we can point towards very clear messaging that hopefully maybe, and this is a question for Jeff, do we get these folks to sign something that we told you this, you understand this, you're losing benefits if you do not start taking them immediately, et cetera. But as long as we cover our bases, again, we have to do right by employees, so we pay them. And going forward, we make sure we let them know very clearly what's going on. That's all I have.
Agree.
Thank you.
Christina, do you want to entertain a motion? I'd be happy to.
So let me think about this just for a sec. Sorry, Christina. So, you know, we can't decide things in executive session. We need to approve any motion outside of executive session. And what I hear us talking about is an amendment that is going to grant retroactive benefits to age 60 for those who have already attained age 60, but not for those who haven't. And so,
I think that's weird. Yeah, I think that's weird because we're saying that going forward, we want to make sure everybody collects it at 60, correct? I thought that was clearly what I heard David and Scott say, that we budget, we already account for them as if they're retiring at 60, that we're going to do everything to make sure that they collect at 60. So if everything is set at 60, for this second group, why don't we just leave everything at 60? I mean, that's where the exposure is.
Well, that... Because
in 5 years, somebody else is going to be having the same discussion we're having today and would probably decide exactly what we're doing today is retroactively pay.
That's fine. Then what we would be talking about is an amendment that promises retroactive payments to age 60.
And does it have to be that specific? I just want to make sure. Can't we just say that for this group A and group B, as discussed in this executive session, the retirement benefits began at age 60? Like, do we want to go into that specific? Does that not suffice in explaining when the benefits began?
Well, I think what I was proposing was my attempt to do what you're saying, which is for those who have already attained age 60, benefits are retroactive to age 60. But then the implication is that for those who haven't yet attained age 60, it's not going to be retroactive. Instead, we'll be much clearer about our communication with them and the consequences of failing to collect a benefit at age 60. But as for the amendment, we're only promising these seven a retroactive payment. And the way I'm envisioning that amendment to specify this group of seven, it's the people who have already attained age 60 and have an elected early retirement benefit.
And I'm agreeing with you. The first seven, I think everybody's in agreement that we want to make them whole. But I guess the piece I'm confused about is we're talking about this group B that has yet to reach it. And we're saying we're going to do everything to get them to collect it at 60. But the retirement age is 62. And then your advice to us that if those individuals came back and sued us, they would likely win. So to me, as our attorney, you're already telling us that our decision is not likely to prevail, right? I think I would be more comfortable agreeing with this 62 if you said we have a stronger case. But what I've heard you say a few times is that although we could make it more clear for this 62, that if somebody challenged us, we would likely lose. So I'm like saying, if our own attorney is telling us we're gonna likely lose, and Scott's saying that we're already budgeting accordingly, why are we creating another problem for people that are gonna come after us if you're advising us that we have a losing case?
Well, the only nuance I put on that is that I don't know that I would say that I was saying you would likely lose in that case, but I do think that there is a risk you would lose, and the way to avoid that risk is to draft an amendment that promises retroactive benefits to age 60, and then you do avoid that you avoid that risk.
So would that, I mean, really it's that we're going to pay the seven, and what I'm hearing, I mean, the amendment would be, which was your I think your number one, Jeff, originally, but that we go back and we change the normal retirement age in the plan, and that would be the amendment to age 60 for everybody, which really resolves it for everybody going forward. So then there's no risk. Again, we're still going to put in the practices so that we're not having to hopefully pay many of these lump sums. Again, I would still go back to the one person that we're having to do this, you know, 54,000. I did reach out to her prior to her 60th birthday, and yet we are still here. So there are those that maybe would kick the can, or, you know, would forget or whatever. But if we change the normal age to age 60 back in the plan, then there is no risk of this impairment of contract claim.
But can I just say something? I'll tell you, I am comfortable coming out of executive session and making a decision for the seven. I think I would be comfortable with a resolution being drafted for the second group, in which we could clearly see, like, who are we talking about? How many people are we talking about? What is the financial impact of them? I think Scott said they've already accounted for that. And I think at that point, once we understand what we're agreeing to on the second group, we could be prepared to, if we talk about it in executive session again, but absolutely be prepared at the very next meeting, since there's not that urgency on that second group. I think I would like to see the language to ensure that we are making a decision that, number one, we have the authority, and that we were not putting the plan in any undue risk. Because I do hear, Jeff, you continue to say, even though maybe you did not say we would not win, you continue to say it's risky. And I want to make sure that if we take risk for the plan, that we understand that risk and that we feel it's in the benefit of the plan. So until I think we have that language, I would propose we not make a decision on that. So maybe we'll come out of executive session. Can we just decide on the seven? Is that acceptable? Because I don't think we're going to get anywhere just talking about it.
Yep. Thank you, AJ. I think that makes sense. So I'll take us out of executive session so we can vote on the seven. And then Jeff, you will bring back the language, proposed language for us for the new process as well with regards to how we're going to handle this going forward so that we can avoid these issues in the future. So at this point, I'll take us out of executive session back into our regular pension trust meeting. So is that all I have to do?
Yes.
Okay. So now I guess I'll make a motion that we approve to pay out to the 7 vested members, both in group 1 and group 2, group 1 being the participants where they received the certification with a incorrect normal date, and the second group being the participants that had the correct date, but where they didn't make their claim, and that we pay the retroactive benefits of, I guess it's $110,000 is what I believe you said?
Approximately.
Is that correct?
That's the approximate amount, yes.
Okay. The motion is to approve the retroactive benefits for those 7 vested members.
Second.
Is that correct?
You got a first.
All in favor?
Aye.
I'm sorry, what's that?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. So the motion passes, and so the actions for the next meeting are to come back with the wording change for our plan to grant the retroactive benefits. Either we change normal age back to age 60 or to grant retroactive benefits for those age 60 and have an amendment that with the correct language, Jeff.
That's fine.
And then I believe David, you'll work on what the go forward process will be so that we can avoid this in the future.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone.
Yeah, thank you very much. I know it's a business? Very complicated issue, so I do appreciate your assistance on this.
Just for one final point for clarity for when you see this language next time, it won't be to change normal retirement age back to age 60. It will be in a different form, which will essentially accomplish the same thing, but I will leave normal retirement age at 62.
Okay.
That's there.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you, Christina. Thanks.
Anything else?
Not from me. You've heard enough from me.
Thank you. Have a wonderful rest of your day.
Thank you.
Thank you. You too.
Bye.
Bye.